Why don't we start with why you are deciding to run for a seventh term? If you are elected and you serve for the full 4 years, you will have served 28 years on New Hanover County's Board of Education.
Yes, ma'am. And why am I doing it? First off, I enjoy it. I really do. I have a number of people come to me and tell me they wouldn't do the job of being on the Board of Education for all the tea in China. But I do enjoy it. And I like to believe that I serve a purpose. I've got a lot of institutional knowledge. At the board meeting last night, I talked about the fact that we have been through, or I have been through, probably 7 or 8 redistrictings. I have been through 4 or 5 bond issues. I have seen the school system grow. I have a strong knowledge of what I believe we need to do to continue to make this system grow. I have been involved in the hiring of 3 superintendents, and I'm very proud of the one we have now. So it's for those reasons that I have said I would like to serve another term.
So what specifically, when you look back at the last 24 years, what specifically do you think your presence has done? How have you benefited New Hanover County school system?
Well, I think I have benefited by being a voice for growth, for educational projects. For example, the technical and career education high school that we have just recently opened. I have advocated for that for the last, 20 years, and was unable to get Cape Fear Community College and the school system to come together. I will give credit to those who did move forward with bringing it up again, and I think it turned out just to be the right place at the right time. I would like to see that college be, that high school be bigger. I think we have been too conservative. I have been to a National School Board Association meeting where I heard a discussion about creating a technical high school in Texas, a school system smaller than ours, and it took them 3 years to have 1,200 students. Right now we have 80. So I think we have been very conservative, but the problem is we don't have our own building. In their case, they had a building to put it in. I am happy about the renovations we have done. I think I have contributed to that, especially the 2 new gyms at Hoggard and Laney, which also, I must say, people don't know this. We have, in fact, created additional educational space at Laney. We have 9 additional classrooms because we took the old media center and made it into classrooms and built a new media center. I also believe that we have expanded some things, such as the engineering program at Snipes, the arts program at, I'm messed up there. The engineering program at Freeman and the arts program at Snipes. So I like to believe that I have been, if not the innovator, a contributing factor to getting those things accomplished.
What do you think is the biggest challenge facing New Hanover County schools now?
Funding for our buildings. And that is not to criticize the county commissioners. I want to be clear about that. I am not criticizing them. But if we were to be able to bring all our buildings to conformity with what is expected by the state, we need about $500 million. And that's a big chunk of money. So that's one of the things I think is a major challenge. How to settle the problem of redistricting. We had a discussion last night at our board meeting, and there's disagreement as to whether or not we should redistrict. Should we use mobile classrooms for a while to see whether or not a large body of students pass through without us having to build, especially if the demographer is suggesting that we may level out, if not decline, in our high school and middle school enrollments.
And who are these demographers? Where are they?
It is a, I don't know the name of the company. I can't tell you right yet. But
were they hired by the school board?
They were hired by the school district. And actually, they did the demographers' projections 5 years ago. And as a result of that, I am told that they missed the projection by about 1%. So it was very close to what we actually had to happen. And that was a time when we were growing pretty rapidly. We had a demographer several years ago, probably back in about maybe 20 years ago, who came. And initially we were going to build a middle school in the northern part of the county. And he said, no, you need it in the southern part of the county. And that's why Ashley, Murray, and Anderson are where they are, is because we were told the growth was going to be in the southern part of the county. Interestingly enough, the growth in this county is at the extremes. It's down in the south, and it's up in the north. The two primary high schools in the center, New Hanover and Hoggard, are not really growing in enrollment. Both of them are under capacity, not by huge numbers, probably less than 100 students, but trying to encourage people to think about potentially maybe the Lyceum program at New Hanover, the International Baccalaureate program at Hoggard. Laney has a STEM program, and Ashley has a small marine science program. So trying to move these kids around, if you will, and recognize that parents have a real interest in where their kids go to school, trying to be fair to everybody.
Now, we spoke with another candidate running for the school board, a Republican candidate. You have three challengers this year, so
right.
it's a crowded field.
It is.
And this particular candidate gave the board a C+ when it came to long-range planning. Do you think that the current board has dropped the ball a little bit when it comes to preparing for this population growth?
Well, two things. Number one, we got a demographer who says we don't have potential population growth.
And again, to be clear, you're just talking about the student population.
Student population.
The population in New Hanover County, this guy says, will continue to
grow.
Oh,
absolutely.
But your student population will level out when?
They're saying about 2000, between 2025 and 2030. So on the issue of student population, right now, our demographer, and he's the professional, is saying that we're not going to have a large number of students coming into the county. So any thoughts about that is misguided. I don't know that I would expect a challenger to the board to give us a very good grade. But the fact is, we do have a 5-year and a 10-year plan that we would like to implement if we have to. For example, with Laney, the plan is to take Trask Middle School, incorporate it into Laney for ninth graders, and allow that 600 or 700 capacity middle school become an adjunct to Laney, and therefore Laney could then hold about 2,700 students with one, and then construct a new middle school on the 73 acres we have on Sidbury Road. And that's why that was bought.
So that would be dealing with the fact that Laney by itself is more than 25% over capacity.
It's about 390. Over capacity.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a 2,300 student school. So, you know, say 400 rounded off. And one of the things with redistricting was that even after redistricting, it was still going to be about 300 over capacity. I mean, all this redistricting was actually only going to take about 100 students out of Laney.
Why did the board decide to delay redistricting in this case? I mean, this is something that a lot of people have said. The need has been a long time coming. Oh, it's finally happening, and then it gets delayed again.
redistricting this time around has been a rushed project. In the past, we would have started, if we were going to redistrict for now, we would have started more than a year ago. And we would have had meetings. We would have went out to the various sections of the county, had public hearings. I understand the superintendent says to us, you know, we're in the 21st century. We can do it by email. We can do it by text. You don't have to have 400 people come and tell you what they think. So that has caused this whole process, I don't want to say to run amok, but it is not, I have not been comfortable with it.
It's got to be difficult. I mean, you're hearing also from a lot of parents who don't want their kids moved.
Absolutely.
To different schools.
We heard from, I mean, I know for example, a parent who came to one of our meetings, who took the time to come. I mean, it's one thing to sit down and type stuff out. It's quite another to actually take the time to come to a meeting. Who said to us, you know, what about my child who maybe is currently a freshman or a sophomore even, who is playing sports and maybe, okay, he's getting to play. He or she's getting to play. If they go to another school, they won't have the background with the coaches and everything. Clubs, they may be a vice president of a club. They go to another club. There's already a vice president who's going to move. You know, it is. It's a trying experience for a high schooler to be moved. Now, I would say,
and from where you sit, no matter what move you make, you're going to have arrows coming at you from people who disagree with what you're doing.
Whatever we do is wrong.
Right. That's the nature.
I understand that. So I'm taking some criticism as chairman of the board from both sides, from the people who say, let's redistrict right now. We got to do this, da-da-da-da-da-da. And actually from friends of mine who say, wait a minute, you've crossed us up. You said we were going to put a stop to this, and now you have said, no, let's have some work sessions and let's talk about it and let's go through the process. And I have already told Eddie Anderson, who is our assistant superintendent for facilities, I said, okay, Eddie, here's what I want us to discuss. And I'm looking that we're going to probably have, in my opinion, 4, maybe 5 work sessions that are going to last 2, 3, 4 hours, where we will sit down and we will we will try to work out what is a good solution, if there is a good solution.
This is something that the county has grappled with for years.
Well.
And so it's not going to be simple.
It is not simple.
But your own superintendent, there was an email that came out that acknowledged the system, the current school system, is failing minority students, which is certainly tied to that issue because there is this link between high poverty and high minority school populations. And those are the failing schools, generally.
Well, I understand that. The problem is we have been committed, I am committed, to neighborhood schools. And when I say neighborhood schools, I don't necessarily mean that you go to the school closest to your home. What I do mean is you do not drive by the front door of a school to get to a school. Now, if you take schools like Freeman and Snipes, the population that is around them is what's making up the population's school. Now, I have long, probably 15, 16 years, have said it will be impossible to have diversity in our public schools until the city and the county do something about housing patterns. Till we have diversity in the housing patterns, and I read an article the other day that said just that. It is important for communities to have diverse housing. Until we have diversity in our housing patterns, we're not going to have diversity in our schools because the population of New Hanover County will not tolerate, I don't think, putting their children on buses as they used to do back in the 80s to send them somewhere to create some kind of social experiment.
Do you think there's a benefit for a student of color who goes to a high school that is, let's say, in a mostly affluent, mostly white neighborhood? Will that student of color benefit more from going to that white affluent high school?
It's not going to hurt them. Whether it helps them, we did that from the time they started cross-busing. And the data seems to indicate that while there was some improvement, there was not a case of total equality. And a lot of people get mad at me when I say this. It's the parents. The involvement of parents in their child's education is the greatest impact on how well a child succeeds. An example. Children who go to U.S. military schools run on bases, there is virtually no difference between minority kids and Caucasian kids. But the reason is, as I am told, if your child is not performing, then they make sure you get help. And that's one of the things we do try to do. We do try to get...
Let's flip that question a little bit. So let's take that affluent white student who does have a lot of parent involvement.
Yes.
And let's put him in the high poverty, high minority school. Is there any benefit for that white student to go to that school? Is there any detriment?
I believe it all depends on how much interaction there is between the two. And that's the other question. That's the other thing. If you go to any one of our schools, you will find that for the most part, and I'm not saying 100%, but for the most part, you're going to find that most of the Caucasian or affluent kids are going to be sitting together and doing things together, and most of the minority kids are going to be sitting together and doing things together. I heard Frances Weller talk about when she was at Alderman and then when she went to middle school, because her and her sister had been the only two minority children at Alderman at that time. And they went to a middle school, and actually they were ostracized by the other minority kids because she knew the Caucasian kids. And so she hung out with them, and they were criticized by many of those kids who came from.
So when
diversity.
You,
diversity is the secret.
It is. So when you think of yourself as board chair and who you're representing, do you represent those high poverty schools as wholeheartedly and as much as you represent the schools that are doing well?
Yes, I do.
So what's to be done then about those failing schools?
Well, what's to be done? The question becomes, can the school system eradicate issues, social issues, that the community creates? And that, I mean, again, I know the mayor gets all mad at me when I talk about, why do you continue to build housing projects in traditionally minority neighborhoods? Why don't you build them out somewheres? And the same thing. I mean, actually what's starting to happen, go up North 4th Street and see the construction that's going on North 4th Street and see who is starting to live in those houses.
That's right. There is some gentrification going on there.
That's private. And it is becoming what I think the term is gentrified.
Right, which also means people who've had affordable housing there, often minorities,
right,
are now being forced out because they can't afford. The fact is rents are going up, the cost of real estate goes up.
Subsidized housing. I mean, I would, from that point of view, but I would say to the city, I would say to the county, you're in a position to make application for grants to do housing in other areas of the city and the county. And I know people say, well, not in my backyard. But I mean, the fact is that we have, there are minorities in my neighborhood. There are minorities in the apartments in my neighborhood. All the apartments that are being built, I'm sure they're not looking at, are you white? Are you black? But the problem is, can some minorities afford to live in some of this housing? I mean, when you're talking new rents of $1,300, $1,400, $1,500 a month, somebody's got to help these individuals out.
So, yes, yeah, so there is a housing issue. People tend to self-sort. We know that. But from the school board's point of view, and I'll just ask this one more time, then we need to move on to to some other issues. But just from where you sit, and understanding also parental involvement is a factor in student success, certainly. But as school board chair, what responsibility is in your lap and what can you do to make it better for that child who does live in the inner city and who is struggling and doesn't have a stable home life?
I don't know what I can do about an unstable home life. I mean, we have social workers in all our schools. We have counselors in all our schools. If we find out a child is being abused or is being neglected, we will address it. But in answer to your question, also, I suspect that if you went to the rank and file parents who live in what you're describing as a socially, economically deprived area, they would tell you they love having this school as a neighborhood school because they can walk to it. Their child can possibly walk to it. They can do things. If they live on Rankin Street and their child attends, let's say, Parsley, many of those individuals don't have automobiles and the buses don't go there. And unfortunately, we have seen that when we have sent activity buses out to bring them, they don't feel comfortable. One or two will come. We'll send a 40-passenger activity bus, and they'll come back with two or three, four people on it for like a PTA meeting or stuff like that. So that's the reason. When we try to put schools in neighborhoods, and I know I'm plowing this ground over and over, but until the city and county start recognizing the importance of diversity in housing, we're going to continue to have a problem.
Okay, so what you're saying, I want to make sure I'm characterizing this properly, is the city and county need to address housing issues first. Once there's diversity in housing, then it will naturally occur in the school system, but that is not something the school board should be trying to engineer themselves.
Yes.
Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, ma'am. That's my opinion.
Okay. So let's
I'm not saying that's all the board members, but it is my opinion.
Sure, and that's what this is about, just where you're coming from.
Yes, ma'am.
And, when it comes to finances, we've had so many conversations recently about school safety and the need for more mental health resources. What is the board doing on that front?
Okay. On school safety, let me start with the hardware, if you will. We have put in secure doors that in elementary schools that they're the only doors you can come in. All the other doors are locked from the – they're locked. You can get out them, but you cannot get in them. And there's a buzz-in system that you have to buzz, and they have to let you in. Now, it crossed my mind this morning, maybe what we ought to do is just put solid steel doors, because if you go back to Sandy Hook had a buzz-in system. So the guy just shot all the glass out and then stepped through it. So if we had a solid steel door as that front door, then they'd have more problem. We have... At the middle schools, the same thing, a little bit more complicated. This year, we are now reaching out to the high schools. We are in the process of seeking bids to install a process whereby doors, except the front main door coming in, will be locked except during like class change time, and it'll be on a computer, and systematically it'll unlock and lock the doors back. The problem with the high schools is you look at a high school like Hoggard. I think Hoggard has like 73 doors that can get you in from the outside. I mean, it's a challenge. One of the reasons we replaced Blair and College Park is because, as somebody described Blair was like a Motel 6. All the doors opened out. So it's being replaced. College Park is being replaced because it was pods, and kids had to go outside to go from one place to another. So those two are being replaced. The plans in the future, if we get another bond issue, is to replace Mary C. Williams and Pine Valley, because they are both pod schools.
And then what about mental health resources?
Mental
That's
health.
The hardware. And
yes. Okay. That's the reason I wanted to say the first was the hardware. Yes. All right. Then mental health. I was part of Chairman White's roundtable, and a lot of what we talked about was mental health. And one of the things I said at that roundtable was, it is important that we have counseling for kids, even in the elementary school. Now, and Chairman White was in agreement, and he felt that the county commissioners were going to be responsive to providing us funding for mental health counselors. The problem is, a lot of times those people can make, like everything else in education, they can make a lot more money outside the educational environment. But we have in our budget request, I believe it is a request for three school psychologists. We actually need six, but we're requesting for three. We also, I wanted to mention, human resource. All of our high schools have SROs. The two in the city, which are Hoggard and New Hanover, have two sheriff SROs and one city police SRO. Laney and Ashley have two SROs provided by the sheriff's department. Every one of our middle schools has at least one SRO, and elementary school, using a grant that we were able to get from the state along with funding from the sheriff and through the county, we have one SRO for every three schools, and they're like a district. And so the SRO officer moves around between those schools.
Do you see any upside to arming teachers? Is that something that...
I am basically opposed to that. I have said that, you know, if a teacher has a legitimate concealed carry permit, that means they've been through the thing, and they wanted to bring a weapon to school with them with the permission of the principal. I'm okay with that, but I am not an advocate of arming teachers and suggesting that they should go get an concealed carry permit.
Now, you mentioned that the county commission has been very good to the public school system, and they're talking about giving you funding for additional mental health resources.
Sure.
The school system has been building up a fund balance over a number of years. What is the fund balance now, and at what point will you say, okay, we're at the right place, and anything over this amount we can start spending down?
Well, first off, the fund balance has been spent down. Traditionally, it's been about 10% of our estimated budget, or 2 months of operating funds. And part of that was, as somebody has often said, we're in a hurricane zone. And if we have a hurricane, yeah, FEMA might ultimately come in and pay us, but we've got to fix that building now. We've got to get stuff done. And so we were trying to keep 2 months of funding in our fund balance.
Which is how much?
Well, it used to be in the neighborhood of $9 million. It is now down to about six.
That's what you have in the fund balance?
Yes, $6 million.
$6 million. Okay.
But that's only, now again, that's only for about, that's enough to operate us for 2 months to fix things and all. The other thing that you need to acknowledge, we use that fund balance, for example, for one-time capital repairs. Some things the lottery does not pay for. Some things we get $2 million in capital funding from the county, and for that I'm thankful. But, you know, the idea that we've got millions and millions and millions of dollars is not true. Right now it is roughly 6%. Our policy calls for it to be at 7. So we're about 1% under what our own board policy calls for. And I think it comes down to a situation. The county, we hadn't discussed this with the county, but I think that having our own funds that we can reach into when we need them to make things balance, so maybe we don't have to ask the county for as much money, especially for one time. You know, if we have to buy school buses, I don't know if you know how that operates, but we have to buy them the first time, then the state replaces them after that. Same thing with we have to buy activity buses. If we have to replace an activity bus, we have to pay for it. The trucks and everything that you see running around doing things. Now, I will say this. I am very proud of the fact that so many of our trucks had a lot of miles on them, but they still cranked and they still ran. They just looked bad. So I ask, why can't we just paint them and make them look prettier? Why get rid of a truck or van that maybe has 130,000 miles on it, but in the morning when you turn the key, it does crank. But it's just kind of an embarrassment to have one of those things running around. So we did that. And actually, I got a thank you note from the director of vehicles management saying that had saved us over $100,000 that we didn't have to go out and buy new vans and new trucks.
Finally, we're just about done with our time. We recently had a discussion on Coastline, our public affairs show, about charter schools and their role in the traditional public school system. Okay. And there was a lot of talk about the fact that the original idea behind charter schools was they would develop best practices and then bring those into the traditional public school systems. And we heard from folks who essentially said, charter schools have exploded. There are lots of them and more coming, but we're not seeing any kind of cross-pollination. We're not seeing these best practices brought to the traditional public school systems. Should the school board be creating a protocol for doing that? And we basically learned there's no mechanism for it.
Well, first off, you spoke a little bit ago about minority children, and I realize there is the Douglas Academy, but for the most part, if you go down the list, maybe they're on some free and reduced lunch, but for the most part, the charter schools are not taking a lot of our poorest children. And if they do, if they get in trouble, they send them back to us. The funding for the charter schools, and we had this discussion last night also. The state funds charter schools based on their enrollment. And once that enrollment has been set, they get that money in a lump sum for the whole year.
Right. And so even if a kid leaves that charter school, goes back into traditional, and so the traditional public school system winds up eating that cost. But is there so?
Okay, so let me. All right,
go ahead.
Then I just wanted to make sure that was known that there is no mechanism for the money. The money follows the kid, but it doesn't follow the kid back.
But since charter schools are technically public schools, is there a way that the school board can say, all right, since we're helping to support these charter schools, we're also going to make sure that we get some of these best practices coming out of them?
Well,
is there a way to do that?
The state legislature has set up the rules and regulations for the charter schools. And that's the reason on the funding. That's the way they are. I have long advocated for hard-to-fill positions. I mean, I think having an education degree is a wonderful thing. But for hard-to-fill positions, the state should allow us potentially to hire individuals, let's say a chemist who has retired from GE or somewheres, who is not ready to hang it up but wants to come back. But now he has to go for 18 hours at UNCW and get a teaching certificate. He knows chemistry, a mathematician, and most especially foreign language. I mean, I would advocate that if we've got people who have a degree in a foreign language, but they haven't been to education school, we should be able to hire them, whether it's Chinese, Arabic, French, Spanish, whatever. They can have up to 50% of their students. I mean, their faculty, I believe it is. Used to think it was 25. I've been recently told it was 50. But do not have to have teaching certificates. That would be a wonderful thing if the state would say to us that in hard-to-fill positions, you can hire people who, and would not require them to get 18 hours. If they want to go get it, fine.
The regulations for charter schools are certainly fewer and less stringent than they are for traditional public schools. And so you're saying the state, the Department of Public Instruction, should loosen the regulations for traditional public schools and let the local school board have more autonomy.
And have a level playing field, if you will. As far as best practices, we're always looking for best practices. We're not necessarily suggesting that the charter schools have a monopoly on what is best practice. I mean, Dr. Markley, Dr. Smith, Dr. Holliday, they're constantly searching the internet, searching out books and magazines and everything that talk about educational best practices. We're not living with our heads stuck in the sand. I don't know that the best practices of a charter school are necessarily the best practices for a public school that does not have the kind of population that charter school has. I used to think that. I used to wonder, hey, you know, School A has a program, and it seems to be going blockbusters, doing great. We're excited about it. How come we're not doing it over here at School B? And what I am told is, well, you have a different population. What works in School A because of their population may not work over here in School B. So we have to, I am not as concerned about their, quote, best practices as I am the policies and procedures that they are allowed to operate under.
And that's our time. Ed Higgins, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, it's been a pleasure.